This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 199. Today we speak to Dr. Daryl G. Hart about Van Til, Barth, and American Evangelicalism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is episode number 199. I'm back in the studio here on campus at Westminster Theological Seminary. Very thankful for them providing a space for us to record. And just like last week, I have with me today Dr. Daryl G. Hart. The magic of recording. I can record two things in one day and then split it up over 2 weeks. So very pleased to have Daryl here back in the studio. He's a visiting professor at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back, Daryl. It's good to have you again.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Again.
Did you notice the Machen portrait?
I did.
Have you seen? That wasn't here last time you were here.
No, it wasn't. That's a great frame, too.
Well, thanks. We have something, a print on the wall. I framed from reformationart.com. I'll give him some free time on there, our friend Andrew Moody, and you can get some great photos and prints of various Reformed figures. So I have this really beautiful picture of Machen just looking at us, very stately, like staring over our shoulder. And I have some questions on Machen today.
Okay.
But he's not the subject of interest. Today we're going to be talking about, interestingly enough, Karl Barth and American Evangelicalism, but focusing our discussion on Van Til and his criticisms. Daryl has a chapter, actually it was a conference presentation, a paper that he delivered on the subject that has now made its way into a new book by Erdmans, Karl Barth and American Evangelicalism. It is edited by Bruce McCormick and Clifford Anderson. And you can pick that up through the Westminster Bookstore, WTSBooks.com. It's a nice volume. This was a conference that was conducted or convened in 2007, and the book just came out probably about a month ago, so we're going to talk about that today. But of course, I do need to mention that we are a 501c3 organization, and we are listener-supported, and we thank you so much for all of your support. Please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to lend your help today to what we do here at Reformed Forum. We do rely on all the generous gifts and donations and also the prayers of all of our listeners and supporters, and it's you that keeps us going, not only because you listen and we feel like what we do has some meaning, but also because you support us and help us to not only record all the content, but also to deliver it and distribute it to people all over the world. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate today and help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. We thank you so much for your support of everything that we do at Reformed Forum and this program, Christ the Center. Well, this book, I really did enjoy this, and I got this on accident. Not an accident entirely, but I was making a purchase at the Westminster Bookstore and kind of looking through what was new, and I hadn't heard of this book, unfortunately. And oddly enough, not too many people on campus had heard of it either. Maybe that's because I got it so early or whatnot, but it just kind of snuck up on us. And it's a fascinating book, and there's all sorts of contributors in here, people that a lot of our listeners aren't either going to know about or agree with. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. But can you tell us a little bit about this conference? Were you present at the conference?
Yes.
Delivering the paper? This was in 07. Tell us where it was, what the point of it was, and kind of the general characteristics about the
event.
Well,
I think they wanted to look at evangelical reactions to Barth. And They identified Van Til as sort of the kind of the classic
the
response to Barth, which is actually not the case, because I think evangelicals were far more receptive to Barth than obviously Van Til was. But there were historical section, and that was my area where I contributed, although the paper that's also republished here by George Haring, a Dutch historian, is really well done. And I mean, not to pat myself on the back at all, but I think George's and my essays make a nice companion piece to the European and American perspectives on the reception of Bart. But then there were historical theologians, philosophical theologians. The conference had a lot of speculative theology.
Which, well, that's what's going on in Bartianism.
Right, and it just drove me a little bonkers. But I mean, partly because I just couldn't follow it. I'm not gifted in that way. But it was really high level conference held at Princeton Seminary.
Yeah.
It wasn't huge crowds, but it was good crowds, and it was a lot of fun.
I'm a little bit more skeptical of Herring's piece, and with that, this is for another episode.
Okay.
And not speaking to the history side of things, we're not going to talk about Herring's today. But I want to whet the listeners' appetite. Maybe we can have you back on, and we can explore that further. But I know Jim Cassidy, one of our contributors, and I, and some of the other people involved, were a little suspect of his evaluation of what Van Til was doing. That's not to neglect that he's getting at something that's quite interesting, which is the European perspective and the Dutch emphasis, which isn't always treated.
Right. And just to add to that, having recently written a draft anyway of this history of Dutch Reformed Protestantism from the Afscheiding in 1834 down to the Vrijgemaakt and Schilder in 1944, I'm beginning to sense that a lot of Americans, especially outside Dutch circles, don't know really what's going on in Dutch Protestantism. Mm-hmm. And that we think we know what conservative and liberal are here, but what's conservative and liberal over there is different. And that's part of the reason why I appreciated George's piece so much, because he's much more on the inside knowing what's been going on over there. I mean, and in fact, he's working inside both the at the Free University. He runs the archives there, but he also does some teaching at Compen, the school that Schilder was associated with. So anyway, and I think
I don't mean to call any of that into question.
Right.
We can get into the theology and the assessment of what Van Til was doing methodologically for a different episode. And in fact, we will,
because
Jim Cassidy's coming down to the studio in a couple of weeks. So stay tuned. Probably in a month, according to the way things are going to air, to some conversation on that. But the historical essence of it, and it was a historical piece. I don't pretend to say it wasn't. That was interesting. You mentioned earlier about Van Til becoming he has become now a lightning rod for Bartian interpretation. Whether you agree or you don't, you seem to not. Why have people understood Van Til to be the primary or premier evangelical critic of Bart?
Well, I think it's the climate now is one, especially in evangelical circles, where if you have someone to your right, you can then show yourself to be moderate. And it's desirable to be moderate and not extreme. And so Van Til fits the category of an extreme reaction to Bart. And so if I don't, you know, that's an extreme, and I'm not Vantillian, so I'm not extreme. So I can my reception of Bart, my criticism of Bart is sensible, or we can appropriate this but leave that aside. And Van Til was obviously doing something much more foundational in his assessment of Bart.
Oh yeah,
and it's what I try to unpack in this historical chapter, was there was something far more ecclesiastical going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
But evangelicals, I think, can use Bart. I mean, Van Til is kind of a whipping boy to show also what was wrong with a certain time in evangelicalism when evangelicalism was too conservative. And now we're a little bit wiser, more knowledgeable, and so now we can understand Bart better, and there's a lot of good that we can find in Bart and appropriate. So I think that's part of the dynamic that's going on.
Yeah, it's interesting when I think about Van Til criticizing Bart, there's also some just very basic reasons why his criticism is so well known. One of them, it's one of the first ones in the English language.
Right.
And he knew German so well. Herring makes this point that he did know German so well, and his criticisms were published in English. And so many people were learning about Bart through Van Til. and reading his quotations, however many there were, but they were coming to an understanding of this new theology through the eyes and the criticisms of Van Til. And so by default, in many's mind, he became the featured person or the featured English-speaking Bart critic because there weren't other ones out there.
Right.
And in many places, the first mover gets a lot of the market share, so there might just be some really simple historical pragmatic reasons why his criticism has become so well-known in Bartian circles.
And it's also, I mean, it was so categorical. So to say that it's a different religion the way Machen, you know, I mean, his book, Christianity and Bartianism was playing off Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, and so liberalism for Machen was another religion, and for Van Til, Bartianism was another religion.
Yeah.
And in the same way that Hodges' conclusion that Darwinism was atheism has lived on, even though Hodges' understanding of Darwin and biology and evolution was far more sophisticated than that little bumper sticker of a response, that has lived on in all sorts of survey textbooks, etc. Oh, this is the way that, you know, Orthodox theologians reacted to Darwin. And and the same thing can be used, you know, I mean, you have Van Til is kind of a bumper sticker that people can use if they want to.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Machen and the Christianity and liberalism. What was the American Protestant context 20 or 30 years after the modernist fundamentalist debate? What was going on in Van Til's milieu to help us better understand the criticism and situate it correctly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, neo-orthodoxy was in the 40s and 50s, I mean, you still have a polarization between evangelicals or neo-evangelicals, as they were called, and liberals. And people don't know what to do with Bart entirely. When Bart first began to circulate in American Protestantism in the 30s, in English anyway, some people, even in the Christian century, called Bart a fundamentalist because he talked about the Word of God the way he did, and he talked about classic Christian doctrines the way he did. Now, by the 50s, neo-orthodoxy is much more prominent in mainline Protestant circles, but it's the Niebuhrian kind of neo-orthodoxy. Yeah. So, I mean, Bart's doing dogmatics, you know, and his dogmatics are a testimony to that. I mean, how many four volumes, but still it's 20 volumes. But Niebuhr isn't doing dogmatics. Reinhold Niebuhr is doing ethics.
Yeah.
And so what American neo-orthodoxy represents is much more ethical and activist still than a dogmatic approach. I mean, dogmatic in the classic sense, not dogmatic as in intolerant, doing dogma.
Sure.
And so I think American Protestants are still trying to figure out what to do with Bart and where he fits. And evangelicals, especially some of the evangelicals writing for Christianity Today, Jeffrey Bromley is an early interpreter and writer about Bart. He's at Fuller Seminary. And very positive about Bart. And I think, you know, I think that some evangelicals think, okay, this is a further way that we can get somebody, a prominent European theologian, on our side and show what's wrong with mainline churches here, in a way.
Yeah, he was used as, in many ways, Bart was used as an answer to liberalism. So it's interesting what Van Til does. A lot of evangelicals latched onto Bart because they had a common enemy in the Schleiermacher or Schweitzer, all those other figures, and so they saw wow, this could be used as a great tool to combat the problems that we have with liberalism. But then Van Til comes along and writes the new modernism. And then later, Christianity and Bartianism, making just a bold statement about what his assessment of Bart, and that this is not a guy we want to partner up with just because we have a common enemy with liberalism. He's, in essence, promoting the same thing. What many interpreters of Bart, present-day interpreters and present-day Bartian scholars, reject Van Til's assessment. obviously. And some cast Van Til off as just an angry, maybe even a vengeful disputant. But what could we understand about Van Til's ecclesiastical context and really his main concerns that kind of shed light on why his critique might have been so mm-hmm. forceful?
Yeah, I mean, that was the most interesting dimension for me in writing the piece. And so the chapter doesn't deal as much with Van Til, the substance of Van Til's critique, as it does with the historical context. And so the first historical context is bitterness over the loss of Princeton Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And then Princeton tries to stay conservative in the 30s, and they do so by hiring Bardians, in effect. And so Van Til, but not simply Van Til, all sorts of Westminster faculty are pointing out the new hires at Princeton and how these guys might sound conservative, but mm-hmm. they're not really conservative. And it's unanimous among the faculty that they're all Westminster faculty are all showing how Princeton, this is phony conservatism. And so that's what's going on in the 30s, even in the 40s. But the culmination of it is with the Confession of 67, which very much reflects a Bardian understanding of Scripture. And by then, again, the chorus from the whole Westminster faculty, E.J. Young in particular, writing very incisive critiques of what's going on with Bardianism, what's going on in the PCUSA with the proposed Confession of 67 and eventually adopted. And the Guardian, Presbyterian Guardian, devotes entire issue mm-hmm. to the Confession of 67.
It's online too. Go to opc.org now and read it.
And the General Assembly of the OPC devotes a whole, they have a resolution about what's going on in the PCUSA. So the backdrop of all this is still what happened at Princeton, what happened within the PCUSA in the 1930s, and the disagreements over the Independent Board and the Machen trial, and you know whether you know the motives were always on the up and up. There's still a real ecclesiastical struggle going on here between the PCUSA mm-hmm. and the OPC, and that's what explains a lot of what is. What the writers in The Guardian and the professors at Westminster are talking about in their criticisms of Bart, because they're trying to show, see, the church and the seminary have gone liberal and you people don't get it. And the evangelicals writing in Christianity Today don't have any real awareness of that. And for them, they're looking at Bart simply outside that whole context.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they can find bits and pieces of Bart that are useful or not, but they're not really ecclesiastically sensitive, both mm-hmm. to what it might mean for the OPC, but then also to see what it's really doing to the PCUSA.
Many of those issues in Van Til's criticism that you bring up in the chapter have to do with his theology of revelation, and that's mm-hmm. highly related to his actualistic ontology. So we can leave that to the expert Jim Cassidy.
Please
when
do.
When he comes on the program in the future to talk more in detail about the theological concerns, but I'd like to focus on the history today because this is a fascinating discussion. What does Machen and perhaps the theologians of the early years in the OPC, not only faculty members but maybe people in the church context, what do they have to teach us about polemics in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they have that their understanding of that polemics was just part and parcel of being in a seminary, being in a theological world. I mean, this was an academic enterprise, and polemics, academics generally criticize each other, no matter what the discipline.
That's what you do.
So in theology, it wouldn't necessarily be any different, but then there's also at stake orthodoxy, the health of churches. So in some ways the stakes are higher when it comes to theology and biblical studies. So, you know, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why there would be disagreements between Westminster, Princeton faculty, old Princeton faculty, and trends in the broader theological world. Mm-hmm. But then they're also concerned about the churches, and that's that churchly concern again makes it perhaps sound more negative or critical. but you know what I also think is that Machen teaches particularly is not to be duped by pious sounding or sweet sounding language, that somebody might talk about Jesus in reverential ways, mm-hmm. but they may not be talking about the Jesus of the Bible.
That's where the term neo-Orthodox comes from, really.
Right.
And many people use it that way. That
right.
This is not orthodoxy the way we understand it. It's something new, different. And different people have different assessments of whether it's still okay or not. But they're using language. The neo-Orthodox, Bart, is using language that is really traditional. And a lot of people have certain understandings, but then he invests different theological content
right.
in those meanings. And that's something that, you know, I really appreciate how you bring out that a lot of the broader evangelicals aren't even akin or
right.
they're not even picking up that that's what's happening.
Right. It's so just, the polemics is part of discernment.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
And you know, we can all, myself especially, can be careful about maybe the way that we express that the disagreement or the criticism. But you know, I also think on the other side, there is a mentality or a disposition that says any disagreement is wrong.
And that seems to be the trend nowadays.
You know, it's unloving, it's breaking mm-hmm. the spirit, you know, or offending the spirit. I mean, so if we're Christians, therefore we shouldn't be critical of each other or disagree with each other. There mm-hmm. are families that are like this as well. so you know, and if that's, I mean, that just means. It seems to me you turn your mind off.
Yeah.
So if that's what is expected, then of course any kind of criticism is going to look over the top.
Uh-huh.
So you know, trying to recover some kind of understanding of the value of polemics, and even that, you know, you can do it sometimes in a sarcastic or satirical way. I mean, there are parts in Hodge that are very funny. I mean, he uses some imagery or tropes that Warfield does the same. I mean,
Luther.
These guys, exactly. These guys could write entertainingly
yeah.
in their criticism. And, you know, I mean, whatever their motives may or may not have been, oftentimes the substance of what they're saying plus the style with which by which they're saying it is great stuff. And
mm-hmm.
and some people just don't have an appetite for that, but I do. And I mean, not simply that I do it, but I mean, I like to read that kind of writing because I
yeah.
think when you understand that there are differences out there, you can actually think harder about things and you can understand more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, this guy believes this guy believes that. And what are the okay? And you learn from that disagreement. I don't understand why
like
people who
the
want
scholastic
to,
method,
right.
What you get with the Turretin, you know, this we affirm against the Socinians. All the theology is that's what Eclectic theology was, or it's the form of polemics in that sense that it's theology done in conflict with others, and it does help to learn.
Right,
it's a very fruitful avenue to do it, but it seems to be a discipline that's lost on the church today because it just seems like a mean thing, and it's non-Christian, unfortunately. I know you don't like the speculative theology, but let's do a little bit of speculative history.
Okay, sure.
How might Machen have written a response to Bart?
Well, he did. Early on, he wrote a piece in 1928 that was not published.
That's right.
Until Grace Mullen actually discovered it, but then I took advantage of her discovery and had that piece published in the Westminster Journal. So in 28 was when he gave this talk, reading early Bart. And Machen's German was pretty good, too. And of
we
course
lived
that,
there for a while.
Sorry?
He lived there for a
yeah.
little while.
So... And he was like so many Americans and Europeans who are conservative or orthodox. This guy sounds, you know, Bart sounds kind of interesting, especially mm-hmm. what he's, you know, the way he's going back to the Word of God and trying to recover some kind of orthodoxy. They didn't know what to make of it entirely, but, and I don't, you know, I don't think they were reading the Romans commentary of 1919 or so, which would
have
been
the bomb on the playground of the theologians.
Right.
Yeah.
But, so, you know, I think initially, and there were Dutch theologians too, who thought, you know, this may be a way to revive a kind of conservative theology here mm-hmm. among Protestants. And so people didn't know what to make of it entirely, but they wanted to appreciate it in a way. So anyway, you know, had then Machen then, I mean, Machen, once Westminster started, he turned over Bartian studies to Van Til so that he was getting letters often about Bart. What do you think? And he said, no, talk to Van Til. Huh. I mean, partly he was overwhelmed with all sorts of other responsibilities in the 30s. So he kind of gave up on following Bart.
Yeah.
But I suspect he would have tracked right there with Van Til, but then also what Stonehouse and Young mm-hmm. and others mm-hmm. were writing. And again, the ecclesiastical context would have been particularly important, and Machen may have been even more critical than his young associates were when it came to trying to settle some scores with old Princeton.
Yeah.
Or the new Princeton, I'm sorry.
Well, I hear you. Do you think anything would have changed in the criticism via or through Van Til if it was written today, if it was written on this side of the Confession of 67, or if it was written with the present day theological trends?
I guess I wonder if it would have received the amount of attention today that it did then.
Yeah.
That there are, I mean, by now Bart is the only real conservative place to go within the PCUSA. There are so many other difficulties that the mainline churches face. And so people who were trying to keep tabs on the mainline would have had so many other targets.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, because, you know, Bart is offering what is apparently a conservative or orthodox view mm-hmm. of things, the conservatives outside may – you're always critical of the people closest to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they may have still given as much – and say, you know, look, at you guys who think you're Bartian in the church, you want to be conservative in the mainline church. Well, you're not. You know, you still have this problem. So it could have gone that way as well. But there, it was an era when the OPC and the theologians at Westminster or scholars at Westminster were still paying a lot of attention to what was happening in the mainline, especially the Presbyterian mainline church. And that just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, I think after the Confession of 67, the conservative Presbyterians and the mainline Presbyterians go pretty much in very different directions. And
were there any churches that left after the Confession of 67?
There were two or three congregations.
But that's it.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. And it was really...
The Zwickli Church is one of those.
Are there really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. It's amazing in how that was really a confirmation... a validation of what the OPC had done 30 years prior. You know, once that confession was established, they said, you know, see, we didn't do the wrong thing. We did the right thing back then.
And I mean, this dovetails with the other interview we've done about mm-hmm. my history of the OPC, but in then working on that book, seeing the way the OPC pulled out the stops to try to recruit conservatives in the PCUSA over the Confession of 67.
Yeah.
They held conferences in Southern uh-huh. California, and they sent letters out to ministers in the PCUSA, hoping that this was finally going to be the moment when the conservatives, the evangelicals in the PCUSA would leave. And it just wasn't there.
And it's still, I hate to say it, but you still have a wing in the PCUSA or people that are thinking they're conservative and thinking that maybe, you know, with the Presbyterians for Renewal, is that one of them? Or there might be some another group. I'm forgetting. You can remind me within the PC.
Well, the Confessing Church movement, but
yeah.
I mean, I don't know if they're still in or out.
Who knows? But I mean, with this last thing that happened with the Presbytery in Minnesota, I believe, which they finally voted to now remove some language in their church book of church order, which now it's going to allow for homosexual ministers. People thought, well, maybe that will be finally the thing that gets a lot of conservative churches to go, but we're not seeing that either.
Right.
There has been a movement for people to jump in and join in the EPC, but that we've talked about that in the past.
Right.
A little bit far afield from our discussion on Bart today. When I go through and read some of the letters into Van Til archives, that's a really fun thing to do, and something John Meather, of course, has done, and something, and he brings to light a lot of the interesting things in those archives in his biography of Van Til. But one key event in Van Til's life was this 1953 Calvin Forum. And I was struck as I was reading this book, Karl Barth and American Evangelicalism, that some of the Barthians seem to like they're not aware of this Calvin Forum issue, of course, but they seem to characterize Van Til's criticism the way many Van Tilians characterize the criticisms of Jesse DeBoer, Cecil DeBoer, and Cliff Orlebaek in the 53 Calvin Forum. Do you think there's any similarity there, or is there just a false misunderstanding? A misunderstanding.
Yeah.
I don't know enough
to answer the question.
Sure.
So, I just have to take the fifth.
Well, this is great. I guess it gives me opportunity to talk more.
For a
Well, one thing that you find in the Calvin Forum, and we should get John back. He's a shy guy. I'm trying to get him more on the show more often, but he's hard to schedule. They criticize Jesse DeBoer in particular, and this is coming from Calvin Seminary, for people that don't know, in Grand Rapids. And they heavily criticize Van Til for his use of idealist language. And they assume that since he's using words like or phrases like concrete universal or other type idealist language, that by nature he is an idealist. And they it's a very uninformed criticism. I'm trying to be as objective as possible, but it is pretty bad. They're just really uninformed, haven't read and come to grips with their opponent's views, and it's just a really rash, harsh criticism of a theology that they really aren't understanding at all. And Van Til, in many places, says, for one, his dissertation talks about God in the absolute, and he criticizes idealism. He criticizes pragmatism and says pragmatism is just the same as idealism, just as bankrupt as idealism, and they're both non-Christian at all. And in many places throughout his writings, he talks about how he's using these phrases that come from idealism in different ways and trying to invest Christian content in them so that he can communicate to philosophers. So he uses a term like concrete universal, but then he goes to the idealist and says, look, I'm meaning it in a very different way, but I'm trying to communicate to you. So he tries to find a point of contact in terms of phrases and languages. But Jesse DeBoer and others will come and just say, just because he used this word means that it's almost like a word concept fallacy. He must have imported all of Kant or all of Hegel or all of whatever into his philosophy. And then they go about just ripping into him really inappropriately. On an entirely falsely constructed understanding of what Van Til meant. Now we read a guy like Bruce McCormick, or we read a guy like the George Herrick and others. McCormick especially thinks that Van Til has completely, or at critical points, misunderstood what Bart was saying, and that he ripped into Bart unnecessarily, that he overly criticized him because, frankly, he just didn't get it. So I guess that's more of where the essence of my question was coming. Do you think Van Til's criticism of Bart was so harsh because he was criticizing of a Bart that didn't exist, a boogeyman Bart that he invented, or that's the product of his misunderstanding, or do you think Van Til is criticizing him so harshly because of the danger he saw in the theology?
Right. I think the latter. And I mean, I guess the question is, you know, and we see this all the time, especially in polemics. And I don't remember Van Til's writings or criticisms of Barth now well enough to know. But it's one thing to say that the implications of your view is X.
Yes.
Versus you are saying X.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say the implications are X, then you're still giving the person a chance to deny X. And
that's
say,
what they mean.
Right.
Or to clarify that,
right.
Or whatever. Yeah.
But I do see in polemics a rush to jump over implications right to, you are guilty of X. And here I just don't remember well enough what Van Til. I mean, I think it's perfectly conceivable, too, that people would say, even to say that Barth, the implication is of Barth is this, is you can't say that. How could you even think that about Barth, that
right.
he would even countenance that? You know, and if that's going to be your understanding of Barth going into it, then, you know, basically to make no distinction between somebody who's saying implication versus X is...
I think you're making an excellent point, and I think that was one of the main things I think Herrick had trouble with. That was a sticking point of my reading of Herrick. I've got a quotation I want to bring up, but you I think you pointed on something that I wish I would have pointed out because you're bringing a point to... you're sharpening my point and helping me to clarify it better. There is a major distinction... in Van Til's writing, that often he does try to show the implications of a view, and he'll come out so hard against that. And people outside of Van Til's method who aren't familiar with what he's attempting to do apologetically can very quickly think that he says that he insists that that person is saying and believing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an excellent point. That's what Van Til does, though. He's making the trying to draw out the conclusions while not at the same time saying you necessarily believe that, but that's where your view's going.
Mm-hmm.
Herrick says in Van Til's review of Zerbe's book, for example, there is no information about the structure of the book or about the author's thesis. There seemed to be a Van Tilian universe and you were either in or out. Unlike neo-Calvinists such as Bovink or G.C. Birkhauer, you would never learn from Van Til's publications how his opponents reason or what they were aiming at. A little bit later, Van Til is interested in the battle itself, in overwhelming opponents with his arguments, and in showing them how the consequences of their ideas will undermine their own position. I think there's some overly strong language in those that I would disagree with, but there are two points here. One is that there's an antithesis. Of course, Van Til's pushing the antithesis. And if you want to say that's the Van Tilian universe and you're either in and out, well, that's what he's trying to do. He thinks Reformed Christianity is the only plausible option. And so if you're not Reformed, in his mind, you've gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So of course he's going to do that. People not understanding the antithesis are going to miss that point. But yes, Van Til is attempting to show them how the consequences of their ideas will undermine their own position. That's his whole method.
Right.
And so to say that what you brought up is exactly the point, I think, that what Van Til is trying to do in the criticism of Barth is trying to demonstrate this is what Barth has taught, this is where it leads, and this is a major problem. And therefore, he's going to speak out very, very strongly against that theology.
Right.
But a guy like McCormick or a guy like Herrick maybe wants to parse things a little more finely than that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think too, I don't know what George was talking about necessarily when he talks about the review, but if you're writing a review, that's one thing. I mean, and you may have an obligation as a reviewer to
we'll leave that aside.
Try to give some of the content of the book.
Whether that method's appropriate
or
in a book
review. Or are you simply just, you know, you're responding in an essay to a book, in which case, you know, you don't have the obligations of a reviewer necessarily, but you're going to actually just kind of go after the book itself because it represents something that needs to be criticized or analyzed.
Mm. Who has won the battle? Is the battle over? The battle over Bardianism, the battle over liberalism. We'll leave it first in the mainline church. Is the fight done? Is it a lost cause?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there's still pockets of Bart scholarship here and there, but I think the agenda of inclusion is so far removed from what even Bart was trying to do, mm-hmm. that I just don't think Bart has much use for the mainline churches. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's becoming antiquarian in some ways to study Bart. Mm-hmm. I know Princeton tries to keep Bart alive through the Bart Center and some faculty there. And it, I think what they're trying to do is admirable, and I have benefited from it in this book and conference are tribute to that. But I think even within the PCUSA, it's a low key or low priority effort. And I just think that era of the church has passed.
Do you think the battleground has shifted into what most people understand as a reform circle? Remember, Bart is often considered a reform person.
Right.
When I went to the Catholic and was a student, and I say I'm a reformed Christian, the assumption is, oh, could you teach me about Bart? They were asking me questions about Bart, wanting to learn more about Bart. And I said, well, I'm of a very small group of people that you probably never heard of. We're critical of Bart too. And so do you think that's currently
the fight is going more among evangelicals. I think evangelicals are keeping Bart alive in ways that the mainline is not. So I think probably at evangelical colleges and seminaries, Bart would be taught with much more vigor as a serious proposal and a serious way to do theology and think of the church and ministry as well.
Mm.
That's where I think Bartianism probably is strongest right now.
Do you think Bart has any use politically? To try to connect things back to last week's interview?
His great moment politically was with the Barman Declaration and the Confessing Church and the opposition to the Nazi control of the German churches. So in that sense, I think there is a resonance with the two kingdom or spirituality of the church model in early Bartianism and the Confessing Church. But I also sense that, you know, behind the denial of the National Socialist program was also another political agenda. And so where Bart himself was politically, I mean, he was considered the red pastor early in his career. So he was sympathetic to socialism, which, you know, as opposed to fascism, you know, I can understand why that might have been appealing. There weren't the kind of options that Americans have when we come to think about Republicans or Democrats or liberals and conservatives. The European options just weren't there. But I haven't seen much, even from the mainline or evangelical Bartians. It tends to be much more of a call to for the church to back away from activism.
Hmm.
So I think there's a kind of resonance again between Two Kingdom and spirituality of church people with some Bartians.
Here, following along those lines, often you find the spirituality concerns coming out of a strand of Southern Presbyterianism. You know,
right.
Why hasn't the Southern Presbyterian Church seemed to take to Bart as much as the Northern? Or do you think they have?
I think they did during the, for instance, John Leith, a Southerner, Virginia Union Seminary of Richmond for much of his career. I mean, he really was influenced heavily by Bart, continued to be a Bartian throughout his life. I mean, I knew John a little bit toward the end of his life, and he was very friendly and cordial. And I mean, he would tell stories about the controversies that led to the founding of the PCA, where some of the people there thought that he was a liberal because he was Bartian. So, you know, I guess I'd say there probably was a following in the South, especially in the mainline South. And again, I think where do you go for a conservative reformed position in the 20th century? Okay, you could try to repristinate the 17th century and the Westminster Standards, or maybe the Puritans, maybe Kuyper and the Dutch 19th century, but that's a little too foreign for America. Why Bart is less foreign, I don't know, but this looks again like this looks like a conservative opportunity and a way to back away from liberalism to recover some kind of orthodox sensibility and categories. I think it's some of the Southern folk today in the main line who have kept Bart alive, at least in the case of John Leith.
So in many ways, it's either confessionalism or Bartianism.
Right, right.
And then it seems like in terms of numbers, the Bartians have won today. That's an interesting thing to pull out, and we'll try to parse more of this down the road, especially as Jim comes on, and we'll talk more of the theology. But the history here is really just fascinating, and of course, Princeton today still remains one of the centers of Bartian scholarship. The two of the world's well-known Bartian scholars, Bruce McCormick, George Hunsinger, teach there. And if you'd like to read more about Bart, you can read Van Til's Criticisms, Christianity and Bartianism, or The New Modernism, which are available at the Westminster Bookstore. This present book, Karl Barth and American Evangelicalism. There's also Orthodox and Modern, Barth for Armchair Theologians. There's all sorts of books available on Barth. He's such a popular figure. And many of them as well are available from the Westminster Bookstore. So you could pick those up and read it as well. Of course, you can find out more about Daryl online at oldlife.org. You can also visit, I would imagine it's hillsdale.edu. Is that the website?
Yes, that's right.
Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. And it's just a fascinating school, an interesting case study in non-Christian schools, I guess.
Right.
Christian-friendly conservative schools that aren't religious. And of course, you can follow Daryl along there. And go back in the archives and listen. We have a lot of episodes that Daryl's been on. He's been a good guest and been on many times to talk about some fascinating things. And one thing I do want to mention is a whole series that was available on one of our programs called Historia Ecclesia, and it's still available. An entire course, a Sunday school course on J. Gresham Machen. And that is still available. Just do a search on our website, reformedforum.org, for that. And you can learn more about the founder of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, Westminster Theological Seminary, just a great figure in American conservatism and conservative theology as well. A Southerner, too. You can visit us online, of course, at reformedforum.org, which I just mentioned, and visit us online today. Download to your heart's content, listen, and provide feedback to us at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.